Welcome back to There Is a Season, the Pete Seeger podcast. In this episode, we delve into Pete Seeger's legal challenges in facing the House Un-American Activities Committee in 1955 and the impact of Seeger's decision not to cooperate with them. We will also investigate how Seeger's status as a blacklisted artist resulted in the prolific amount of performing and music making he did throughout the remainder of the 1950s into the early 60s, with the multitude of his Folkways albums and live concerts, and the musical foundation he helped to create for other up-and-coming musicians by doing so. Pete Seeger was scheduled to appear before the House Un-American Activities Committee in New York City on August 18, 1955. While Congress had censured Joseph McCarthy a year before, HUAC was still at work, and would be for several years to come, not actually being dissolved as an entity until 1975. Thus, for Pete, when he had received his subpoena at home a couple of weeks before, he had not been entirely surprised. Seeger had anticipated receiving a summons back in the late 40s, during the People's Songs period. He had even had an exchange of correspondence with his father about the possibility of indictment, with Pete saying he, quote, "knew some people who went to jail and it wasn't that bad," unquote, considering that he could be faced with this situation. Charles begged his son not to put himself in the situation if he could possibly avoid it. Pete would learn that he would need to play this upcoming testimony carefully. Pete was a combination of frightened and confident leading up to the August 18th hearing date. The dismantling of the Weavers by the press, FBI, and HUAC had been remarkably sad and disappointing, and now Seeger would have to go through all this again, not to mention the attacks on People's Songs and the Almanac Singers before that. As Ronnie Gilbert put it many years later, quote, "we lost the sense that we were living in a democratic society," unquote. Part of the Weavers' emotions, of course, also had to do with how Decca Records ended up treating the quartet in the end. Now, originally, Decca did extend some mild support to the musicians. When they were playing in Ohio, a couple of FBI agents ended up following Ronnie and the others on the street when Ronnie, knowing they were being followed, turned around and faced them. The agents snidely asked if the musicians would like their subpoenas now or later during their show that evening, to which Ronnie shouted, "We'll take them now." There is some speculation that this was an intimidation tactic and that the subpoenas were actually fake. Decca executive Pete Cameron actually called lawyer Frank Taverner, who was legal counsel to HUAC, in an attempt to buy the Weavers some time from indictment, in the expectation that they would appear based upon those subpoenas they had frighteningly received on the street seemed to evaporate. But Decca's support dwindled when record stores stopped stocking the group's albums. Let's hear Harold Leventhal explain what Decca ultimately decided to do with the Weavers, along with other booking challenges the quartet ended up having.
The crisis of the blacklisting was much more severe than a lot of people even imagined. Number one, Decca Records, in effect, dropped the Weavers. Radio stations would not play Weavers records. Television would not interview the Weavers. Clubs were a problem. There were a number of engagements in which the Weavers went out there and found that there was almost vigilante groups attempting
it. I remember in a place called Daffy's Bar and Grill in Cleveland. I don't know if Ronnie remembers this.
Remember it very well.
A bunch of rather drunken people came in there and interrupted Ronnie when she was about to sing the song to say, "Why don't you sing the Star Spangled Banner?" Ronnie sweetly said, "Well, let's do it sometime when not drunk."
It was bad enough that Seeger lost his source of income because of what certain politicians imagined his political beliefs to be. But now he had to actually face those people. In the short amount of time they had before August 18th, the Seegers had acquired a lawyer, a man by the name of Paul Ross of the Madison Avenue firm, Wolf, Popper, Wolf, Ross, and Jones. Ross had previously worked for New York City Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia and had held a variety of roles as a public administrator for the city of New York. In time, Ross would go on to defend other constitutional and civil rights cases in the coming years. While Seeger was probably in the best hands possible, he ultimately knew he wasn't going to cooperate with HUAC. But this actually made it easier for him. For one, in his eyes, there wasn't a job he couldn't be fired from at this point. But the decision Pete had to face was whether he would take the Fifth Amendment or the First. Since the Hollywood 10 hearings in 1947, taking the Fifth had become the norm in most instances. Indeed, in 1955 alone, the committee called over 500 witnesses, the majority of whom took the Fifth. What advantage would the Fifth potentially have? Well, it would have ended the proceedings pretty quickly, and Seeger would have been dismissed. Harold Leventhal, now Pete's own manager, suggested this is the best course of action. Lee Hayes was also being called to appear, and he had decided to take the Fifth. As he wanted to be done with it, it didn't believe in the hurrah element of sticking it to the committee. The Fifth was, of course, the easier route. But in refusing to answer questions, the Fifth can carry with it the possibility of being labeled guilty anyway. Seeger didn't like this option, even if it would have shortened the process. What was at the forefront of Seeger's mind were the constitutional questions of free speech and free association. In Seeger's view, the committee, or really any political body, did not have the right to violate privacy about someone's political worldview like this, especially when it was being done so uncritically and out of ignorance and political opportunism. In sticking closer to the First Amendment, Seeger would have to accept what could easily come with it, though. Years of court and legal fees, additional hearings and court proceedings, and Seeger could potentially have a sentence of a year in jail for every count of contempt the committee cited him for. In facing the committee, what Seeger wanted to do was to attack the congressmen very openly for who they were and call them out for their hypocrisy. Specifically, he wanted to do something akin to what Paul Robeson did when he had to face the committee in June of the following year. Here is a clip of that testimony, where we hear pieces of the beginning of the conversation, followed by what Robeson says towards the end.
Did you file a passport application in July 2, 1954?
I filed about 25 in the last few months.
In July of 1954, were you requested to submit a non-communist affidavit?
Under no conditions would I think of signing such an affidavit. It is a contradiction of the rights of American citizens.
Are you now a member of the Communist Party?
Oh, please, please, please.
Please answer, will you, Mr. Robeson?
What is the Communist Party? What do you mean by that?
Are you now a member of the Communist Party?
Would you like
Party?
To come to the ballot box when I vote and take out the ballot and see?
Mr. Chairman, I respectfully suggest the witness be directed to answer the question.
You are directed to answer the question.
I invoke the Fifth Amendment and forget it.
I respectfully suggest the witness be directed to answer the question whether, if he gave us a truthful answer, he would be supplying information which might be used against him in a criminal proceeding. Have you ever been known under the name of John Thomas?
Oh, please, does somebody here want me to put up a perjury someplace? John Thomas, my name is Paul Robeson. And anything I have to say, I have said in public all over the world, and that is why I'm here today.
Mr. Chairman, I ask that you direct the witness to answer the question he's making a speech.
I ask you to affirm or deny the fact that your Communist Party name was John Thomas.
I invoke the Fifth Amendment. This is really ridiculous.
The witness talks very loud when he makes a speech, but when he invokes the Fifth Amendment, I can't hear him.
I have medals for diction. Right. I can talk plenty loud.
Will you talk a little louder?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment loudly.
Sir, who are Mr. and Mrs. Vladimir
Nikiev? I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Do you know a Manning Johnson?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Do you know Gregory Kifetz?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Do you know a Max Juergen?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Max Juergen.
Why don't you have
oath?
These people here to be cross-examined? Could I ask whether this is legal?
This is not only legal, but usual.
While you were in Moscow, Mr. Robeson, did you make a speech lauding Stalin?
I can't remember.
Have you recently changed
your
mind about Stalin?
What has happened to Stalin, gentlemen, is a question for the Soviet Union, and I won't argue with a representative of the people who, in building America, wasted the lives of my people. You are responsible, you and your forebears, for 60 to 100 million black people dying in the slave ships and on the plantations. Mm-hmm. Don't you ask me about anybody.
I'm sure you wouldn't want to discuss with us the slave labor camps in the Soviet Union.
Nothing could be built more on slavery than this society, I assure you.
I would invite your attention to the Daily Worker of June 29, 1949, with reference to a get-together with you and Ben Davis, formerly communist councilman in New York. Do you know Ben
Davis?
One
of my dearest friends. He is as patriotic an American as can be. And you, gentlemen, are the non-patriots.
Just a minute.
You are the un-Americans.
The hearing is now adjourned.
I think it should be.
I've endured all of this that I can.
Can I read my statement?
No! The meeting is adjourned!
It should be.
Ross did not want Seeger's testimony to go like this, and advised Pete strictly that he needed to keep his cool when he faced the congressman. The most effective thing Seeger could do to try and make things work on the basis of the First Amendment, Ross explained, would be to repeat his answer and/or explain why he wasn't going to answer a question. On August 18th, the day of the hearing, there were 8 committee members present at the Foley Square Federal Building in New York City. The actual committee members present that day consisted of Democratic Congressman Gordon Shearer of Ohio, Edwin Willis of Louisiana, and Chairman Francis Walter of Pennsylvania. Also present was legal counsel Frank S. Tavener, Jr., who did much of the talking, and a few other clerks and investigators who did not speak during the hour Seeger was being interrogated. Later in the mid-60s, Seeger stated on Canadian television how he interpreted the ideological foundation of the committee members he was facing.
When the House Un-American Activities Committee wanted to know if you had political connections, you didn't want to answer, and that got you into some serious trouble.
This is because this group of people are actually, their group, in my opinion, a group of American fascists. But their idea of America is America where everybody agrees with them. Shearer of Ohio was a supporter of the John Birch Society. Willis of Louisiana is a small town. Mr. Big, he married the daughter of the local sugar mill owner. And his idea of America is that small town where everybody knows their place and he's on top.
Now, while the transcript of Seeger's testimony is fully available to read, there does not seem to be any publicly accessible audio of the hearing. And according to my correspondence with David Dunaway, there may not have been any audio recording made. In essence, though, this is how the conversation went. Seeger was initially asked about his professional background as a singer and musician. He tried using humor to soften the committee, saying that being a banjo picker was damning in some people's opinion, and saying that he was singing as early as 1925. But this did not faze or amuse the chairman or the congressman. Frank Tavener then went into an onslaught of questions that asked Seeger if he attended certain events and rallies and/or sang at them, based on advertisements in the Daily Worker. Seeger initially responded with, quote, "I refuse to answer that question, whether it was a quote from the New York Times or the Vegetarian Journal," unquote. As he continued to be pressed by Walter and Shearer, Seeger reiterated that they already had his answer from before. All in all, by the end, he had to say this about 50 times. Seeger confidently stated, quote, "I am not going to answer any questions as to my association, my philosophical or religious beliefs, or my political beliefs, or how I voted in any election, or any of these private affairs. I think these are very improper questions for any American to be asked, especially under such compulsion as this. I would be very glad to tell you my life if you want to hear of it." Unquote. Shearer then clarified that Seeger was not relying on the Fifth Amendment, which Seeger stated was correct. He was not going to cite the Fifth. Tavener then pressed Seeger on whether he sang at a May Day rally for the Communist Party in 1949. By this point, the committee was making the conversation repetitious, and Seeger's responses were the same. He explained that he would discuss names of songs and their meaning, but not who might have sung them or where or when. Perhaps the most summative response Seeger gave, outlining what he wasn't going to do, was when he stated the following, quote, "I have sung for Americans of every political persuasion, and I am proud that I never refused to sing to an audience, no matter what religion or color of their skin or situation in life. I have sung in hobo jungles, and I have sung for the Rockefellers, and I am proud that I have never refused to sing for anybody. That is the only answer I can give along that line." Unquote. Eventually, Seeger was asked whether he had sung the song "Wasn't That a Time," and if he had sung it in a particular place on a particular date. Embarrassingly, the committee actually got the title wrong the first time. But Seeger refused to share any details. He offered to sing the song, but was denied the request. Seeger considered whether he should open up his involvement with the party a little, but he knew where it would lead. If he went down that road, he would inevitably open up a can, and the committee would use the whole line to further pry their way in to get Seeger to name names. When told by Shearer that the committee could not accept his answers, Seeger stuck to his approach, and his response was simply, quote, "That is your prerogative, sir," unquote. After an hour of questioning, Seeger was dismissed. The following day, the committee concluded the hearings and returned to Washington to prepare their contempt citations. Seeger would have to wait for the long legal battle that very likely lay ahead. Not all the folk singers called before the committee chose the First Amendment like Seeger did. One such of these individuals was fellow singer Josh White. White, of course, had been listed in Red Channels and had been approached by government officials about knowledge he potentially had of so-called communist sympathizers and other so-called communist front organizations. He was never actually subpoenaed, as some sort of deal was struck that he would go testify voluntarily. As the story goes, White called Paul Robeson the night before White was to appear in front of the committee, telling Robeson he just had no choice but to do it. Robeson apparently asked him, "Well, why do you have to?" White explained it was just something he had to do. Why didn't White refuse? According to Aaron J. Leonard, there is speculation that White was being bribed. It is possible that White was accused in secret of having romantic relationships with certain women, and was extorted not to have this made public. As a result, White needed to potentially keep performing to continue paying off the bribes. If he allowed himself to even take the fifth, he would be in trouble financially and personally. As Aaron Leonard states, this isn't confirmed as the reason for White's decision to mildly cooperate, but it is possible. White never named names, but in his September 1950 testimony, he approached his situation by arguing that he had been misled with some of the groups he had played for, not knowing they were so-called communist organizations. Irwin Silber criticized White in Sing Out magazine for making this decision, saying that White, quote, "repudiated every decent thing he stood for," unquote. While White's statement is unfortunate, I don't think Silber's critique is entirely fair either. It is known that White may have been singled out not just for alleged connections to performing at Communist Party gatherings, but also perhaps because he had publicly attacked Harry Truman for sending blacks to fight in a war in Korea when they did not have equality back home, and he had commonly sung the anti-lynching song "Strange Fruit," actions that may have angered HUAC committee members. But perhaps the most notorious example of a folk musician selling out to HUAC was Burl Ives. As we've discussed before on the show, Seeger and Ives went way back to the early 40s and had performed and made records together. Ives was involved in many left-wing causes like Seeger, but Ives, of course, had a career not just in singing, but also as an actor, and had been somewhat successful in this. In May 1952, Ives voluntarily appeared before the committee. He had been listed in red channels and knew he was on the spot. His career was on the line, and he felt as if he needed to be tactical. Ives stated that he attended, quote-unquote, some meetings in 1944 of a group called the Communist Political Association a, quote, good many years ago, unquote. It was actually 8 years prior, and he had gone to maybe 6 or 7 meetings. Ives said it had been open, but actually, one needed a card to get in, which Ives had. Ives was sidestepping things intentionally because, in addition to what HUAC had on their own, the FBI had a thick set of documents on Ives, and illustrated that Ives had connections to a man named Boris Moros, a musical composer for Paramount Studios in Hollywood who had been spying for the Soviet Union. Moros eventually became a double agent for the United States, but in Moros' statements he told the FBI that Ives was, quote, 100% left as can be, unquote. Ives did not want any of this made public, and as a result, named 4 people to the committee. 2 of these individuals were Ives' former publicity agent, Alan Meltzer, and the popular folk singer, Richard Dyer Bennett. Ives apologized for naming names, but said he couldn't avoid it. In his words, he, quote, made some mistakes, and I want to thank this committee for the very fair and democratic way in which you have heard my story. I believe that in no communist country would such a hearing be possible at all, unquote. Seeger was infuriated by this, and in a review of Ives' 1955 book, Sea Songs, Pete stated, quote, Burl Ives went to Washington, D.C., to the House Un-American Committee, and fingered, like any common stool pigeon, some of his radical associates of the early 1940s. He did this not because he wanted to, but because he felt it was the only way to preserve his lucrative contracts, and that makes his actions all the more despicable, unquote. It was not until 1993 that Seeger and Ives reconciled and performed together one last time before Ives' death in 1995.
There's a little white duck sitting in the water, a little white duck doing what he ought to. He took a bite of a lily pad, flapped his wings and he said, I'm glad I'm a little white duck sitting in the water. Quack, 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 quack.
Despite all these legal black holes and unknowns simmering on the back burner in Seeger's life, as we know, he had concocted a creative way of staying busy musically. Firstly, Seeger was always welcome to come down to the city and record for Moses Ash at Folkways. Seeger would churn out an incredible 6 records a year between 1954 and 1958. A couple standout records from this period were, 1, the 1956 release of American Industrial Ballads. This is a collection of labor songs from the mid-19th through the early 20th century, representing labor struggles in a variety of places affecting an array of working class and immigrant demographics. Most of these songs are short recordings, many of which do not have all the verses included, which Seeger did intentionally to fit as many songs on the album as possible. Some of the songs on the record include 8-Hour Day, Hard Times in the Mill, He Lies in the American Land, The Farmer is the Man Who Feeds Us All, 7-Cent Cotton and 40-Cent Meat, Beans, Bacon, and Gravy, The Death of Harry Sims, and the classic Pittsburgh Town.
Pittsburgh Town is a smoky old town, Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh Town is a smoky old town, Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh Town is a smoky old town, solid iron from McKeesport down, Pittsburgh. Lord God, Pittsburgh. Well, what did Jones and Laughlin steal, Pittsburgh? What did Jones and Laughlin steal, Pittsburgh?
Seeger also employed the short-length recording technique with his series of records titled American Favorite Ballads, of which there would ultimately be 5 volumes recorded in total. This series of records was re-released by Smithsonian Folkways in the 2000s, the first set of songs having been recorded in 1957. The LPs included a nifty booklet insert of each of the song's lyrics, and the record sleeve exhibited an appealing artistic image of an idyllic countryside credited to Ronald Klein. The 139 tracks in these volumes are a vast collection of traditional American folk songs. When we say American folk songs, what we mean are songs that maybe took shape in North America, but their original form came from elsewhere. Now, just as a disclaimer, the quantity of these tunes is too much to deconstruct in this single episode, and we may return to this collection again at another point in the show. But what we ought to appreciate is that Pete's objective with this whole record series was to get the music out there for the people to have and use for their own discovery. Like with anything traditional that Pete recorded, many of these songs likely do not sound like how they were played originally. And this is something Seeger often reminded listeners about when introducing songs when he played live. But for millions of people today, this is likely how they learned many traditional American folk tunes, myself included. Among the songs Pete recorded on these albums, some titles include O Susanna, Home on the Range, America the Beautiful, Jesse James, Shenandoah, The Midnight Special, House of the Rising Sun, The Boll Weevil, Arkansas Traveler, John Brown's Body, Frankie and Johnny, The Titanic, Farther Along, What Should We Do with a Drunken Sailor, and Old Dan Tucker.
Now Old Dan Tucker's come to town, riding the billy goat, leading the hound. The hound dog barked, the billy goat jumped, landed Old Tucker on top of a stump. Get out the way, Old Dan Tucker, you're too late to get to your supper. Get out the way, Old Dan Tucker, you're too late to get to your supper.
But what is arguably one of Pete's greatest studio records from the late 50s is the Folkways album simply titled American Ballads. These are some of Seeger's favorite traditional ballads that he learned in the late 30s and early 40s in the southern Appalachian Mountains. Versions of some of these songs would appear also in the American Favorite Ballad series, but what makes this a unique record is that American Ballads has several tunes that Seeger recorded once and probably never were captured in the studio or live ever again. The record begins with Pretty Polly, the classic murder ballad, followed by The Three Butchers and what is probably Pete's earliest recorded version of John Henry.
I courted Pretty Polly the live long night. I courted Pretty Polly the live long night, and left her next morning before it was light. Pretty Polly, Pretty Polly, come go along with me. Pretty Polly, Pretty Polly, come go along with me. And he was riding along fast as he could ride, when he thought he heard a woman, he heard a woman cry. Johnson, getting off his horse, searching the woods all around, when he came upon a woman with her hair pinned to the ground. John Henry was a little baby sitting on his papa's knee, and he picked up a hammer and a little piece of steel, cried, a hammer's gonna be the death of me, Lord, Lord, hammer's gonna be the death of me, cried, a hammer's gonna be the death of me, hammer's gonna be the death of me.
The fourth track, Jay Gould's Daughter, was, according to sources, written by Charlie Poole and Norman Woodleaf, and is a satirical take on Gilded Age railroad tycoon Jay Gould's daughter Anna, who was well noted for her luxurious spending habits and demands she made to her father.
Jay Gould's daughter said before she died, Papa fixed the blinds so the bums can't ride. If ride they must, they gotta ride the rod. Let them put their trust in the hands of God, in the hands of God, in the hands of God. Let them put their trust in the hands of God.
The fifth track, Titanic Disaster, is the classic song of the sinking of the Titanic ocean liner in 1912, lyrically paying homage to the poor people who did not survive because of their socioeconomic status. This is followed by Fair Margaret and Sweet William, also sometimes known as Lady Margaret, a haunting, modal-sounding murder ballad derived from an old Elizabethan melody.
When that ship left England, it was making for the shore. The rich refused to associate with the poor, so they put the poor below. They were the first to go. It was sad when that great ship went down. It was sad, it was sad, it was sad when that great ship went down. Husbands and wives, little children lost their lives. It was sad when that great ship went down. Lady Margaret sitting in a high hall door, combing a long yellow hair. She saw Sweet William and his new made bride riding from the church so near.
The following track is the traditional song John Hardy, although Seeger interestingly plays it with a minor tuning here, giving it a very different feel than the more well-known bluegrass arrangements that have arguably been the most popular.
John Hardy was a desperate little man. He carried two guns every day. He shot down a man on the West Virginia line. You ought to seen John Hardy getting away, poor boy. Seen John Hardy getting away.
Track 8 is The Golden Vanity, a sea shanty, followed by Gypsy Davy, originally a Scottish or British song about a wealthy woman that goes off to join a traveling group of Romani. The next tune after that, Farmer's Cursed Wife, is a story about a farmer whose wife is taken by the devil, but then returned home after making a fuss in hell. Seeger recorded another version of this at one point called Tiru Tiru in three-quarter time instead of the two-quarter time signature found here.
A lofty ship, and she put out to sea, and the name of the ship was the Golden Vanity. As she sailed upon the low and lonesome low, as she sailed upon the lonesome sea, she had not been out but 2 weeks or three when she was overtaken by a Turkish rebel. Davy come a-riding along, singing so loud and gaily, sang so loud the wild words rung, he charmed the heart of a lady. Come rattle-rattle-ling-go-ling-go-ling, rattle-rattle-ling-go-Davy, sang so loud the wild words rang, and he charmed the heart of a lady. How old are you, my pretty little miss? How old are you, my honey? She answered him with a tee-hee-hee, I'll be in 16 next Sunday. Come rattle-rattle-ling-go-ling-go-ling, rattle-rattle-ling-go-Davy. She answered him with a tee-hee-hee, I'll be 16. There was an old man lived over the hill. If he ain't moved out, he's living there still. Sing pa-dee-ing-ding, pa-dee-ing-ding, diddy-ing, da-dee-ing-ding, diddy-ing, da-dee-ing-ding, diddy-ing-day. Well, the devil come up to him one day, said, one of your family I'm gonna take away, singing pa-ding, ding, da-ding, ding, di-ding, da-ding, di-ding, da-ding, ding, di-ding, ding. Please don't take my eldest son, there's work on the farm and it's gotta be done, singing pa-ding, ding, da-ding, ding, di-ding, ding. Oh, it's not your eldest son I crave.
Track 10, Down in Carlisle, is a ballad about a woman who yearns for the return and affection of a partner from danger. The 11th track after that is St. James Hospital, the melody of which probably has origins in the British Isles and was also recorded by Doc Watson. This is not to be confused with St. James Infirmary, a song different enough to be thought of as a different song.
Down in Carlisle, there lived a lady, being both beautiful and gay. She was determined to live a lady, no man on earth could her betray. Unless it were a man of honor, a man of honor and high degree. Then there approached two loving soldiers this fair lady for to see. One morning, I passed the St. James Hospital. Early one morning, morning month of May. When I looked through the window and spied a dear cowboy. Spied a dear cowboy as cold as the clay. Come sit you down by me.
The second to last song on the record, Jesse James, is the ballad telling the story of the famous 19th century Missouri outlaw. Jesse James is often considered a sensational song, representing the James family as good Samaritans and is sympathetic to the murder of Jesse James. The final track is Barbara Allen, an old English folk song about a character, William, thinking of his love Barbara Allen as he lies dying, followed by Barbara Allen dying of grief herself. Joan Baez had a relatively famous cover of this, as did others, during the 1960s.
Oh, Jesse had a wife to mourn for his life. Three children, they were brave. But that dirty little coward that shot Mr. Howard has laid poor Jesse in his grave. A fair maid dwelling, made many a youth cry well-a-day, and her name was Barbary Allen. 'Twas in the merry month of May, when green buds they were swelling, sweet William came from the west country, and he courted Barbary Allen.
What is interesting about all these songs is perhaps several things, but Seeger's banjo playing definitely stands out. His reputation, at its core, is of course built on musicianship, and he delivers that strongly here. We hear him combine the traditional styles with his up-picking technique, mixed with even some bluegrass finger-picking, sometimes doing all of these in one single song. The other feature of all this is that these songs are studio recordings. The norm for most Seeger fans is hearing him perform with an audience, and this is what we probably prefer to look for when browsing Seeger recordings. The lack of a crowd singing along with Pete does make him sound a bit different than what we're used to, complemented by the fact that there are really no effects here, such as an echo you would hear ring out in a concert hall setting. Mo Ash's recording sessions were done in a very rudimentary, stripped-down manner, practically operating with an archival methodology much of the time. These collections are unquestionably very important, but this was not the extent of Seeger's music during the late 1950s. Pete's first big performance after HUAC was in December 1955, when the Weavers briefly got back together and performed at Carnegie Hall. Leventhal actually rented the hall first, then told the group if they didn't play that he'd lose money, an old show business trick to get your act to perform. Let's hear Lee Hayes and Harold Leventhal discuss the significance of this concert.
The Blacklist forced us to take a sabbatical and a Mondical and a Tuesdical, but after 3 years of not working, we got bored with the Blacklist and mad. The only answer to that kind of crap was to get together again. At first, nobody would rent us a theater, but somehow Harold got us the best concert hall in the country.
I was able to get Carnegie Hall, I think it was in December of 55. Well, that again was a historic concert, of course, sold out very, very quickly, had a tremendous press reportage. We were fortunate enough to record that concert. I took the chance and got the private recording set up. No company would record it. The blacklisting period was, of course, still on.
The LP of the concert, The Weavers at Carnegie Hall, was released on Vanguard Records and includes all their hit songs and more, all well received by an enthusiastic crowd. Despite this concert, it wouldn't be long before Seeger quit the Weavers for good. The other three came to him asking to do a commercial for a cigarette company, and Pete protested this. The others complained that they needed the money, so Pete ultimately went through with it, but not long after, Seeger informed the group, to their disappointment and astonishment, that he was permanently done with the group. Pete recommended Eric Darling, a former banjo student of his, as a replacement for him. Darling went on to perform with the Weavers for a while. After this, Pete knew that concerts like the one at Carnegie Hall were going to be far and few between at this point. As we heard Leventhal and Hayes emphasize, renting space for blacklisted musicians was usually difficult, if not impossible. But it wasn't just the commercialism of things that drove Pete to leaving the Weavers. Moreover, the pop audiences really didn't interest him anymore, and he wanted to engage with his listeners on a different level. At this stage, Pete turned to smaller, less conspicuous venues, not because he was afraid of people seeing him play music, but simply because of access. For some reason, HUAC didn't seem to mind Seeger singing for churches, schools, and summer camps. Ironically, Congressman Willis had even stated during Seeger's testimony that such things were quote-unquote laudable. If HUAC, Counterattack, and the FBI were fearful and paranoid about Seeger's influence, these are probably the exact places they should have prevented Seeger from singing at if they didn't want him working. It's likely that playing for these audiences created more fans out of folk music and meaningful songs than making pop records for Decca. But out of their ignorance, people like Frank Tavener and Congressman Walter clearly couldn't see this. Indeed, as Pete navigated these things, he made some important impressions that would go a long way in just a few years. One of these individuals that saw Seeger during this era was Roger McGuinn. Roger McGuinn, whose first name originally was Jim, was the founding member of the folk rock group The Byrds and had big hits with Bob Dylan's Mr. Tambourine Man and Seeger's Turn, Turn, Turn in 1965. But before that, McGuinn was a five-string banjo player who, after high school, worked with the folk groups The Limelighters, the Chad Mitchell Trio, and later, Bobby Darin. Growing up in Chicago, McGuinn studied with banjo player Frank Hamilton and others at the Old Town School of Folk Music, where he was introduced to Seeger's music. Here is a clip from a radio interview McGuinn did with Seeger in 2007, where McGuinn describes his first seeing Seeger perform in Chicago in the late 1950s.
In Chicago at the Navy Pier, it must have been 1957 or 58, and I had a banjo. It was a Vega long neck banjo, which Pete had invented, and I bought one, and I had it with me at the concert. I mean, the concert was canceled, unfortunately, but I went to the Navy Pier not knowing that, and Pete, being the wonderful man that he is, didn't want to let anybody down who'd come to the concert. He was standing out on the loading dock of the concert hall in the back, and he was putting on an impromptu concert for all of us kids who wanted to see him. And I had my banjo with me, you know, and I talked to him briefly. I was like 16 years old, and he was wonderful. I asked him a few questions. I said, to what do you attribute your popularity? Because he was really popular, that he was filling the orchestra hall and wonderful concert halls around the country at that time. And he said, I think it's because I get people singing along with me, and they hear themselves singing, and then they like me.
A couple of good examples of what a live Seeger show sounded like during this time are his 1957 performances at Cornell University and the University of Chicago. Both these shows are available in full on YouTube, and if you listen, you will discover that the crowd is very strongly participating in the singing. Now, I realize that many will say that singing along at a Pete Seeger concert was the norm, and it was, but it was only a norm because of the work Seeger put into establishing that norm. The students there at both of these settings were clearly his audience, and perhaps they learned some of the songs at summer camps or from Seeger's proteges, or perhaps saw Seeger somewhere else before, or were familiar with the Weavers previously. At the same time, you can tell the audience is a little reticent and has trouble coming out of their shell, which also just shows things were still very proto when it came to audience participation at a Seeger concert. But I think we have enough evidence to suggest that the geographical diffusion of Seeger's music had already been going on pretty significantly amongst younger demographics by 1957. Here is a clip of Hold On, from the Chicago performance in October of 1957.
The nice thing about any kind of folk music program is that it really they get the best singing audiences in the whole world. As a man came to review a concert I was giving in Toronto last week, and he was so perplexed. He says, I was supposed to come and listen to Mr. Seeger sing, and all I heard was the audience singing. He didn't miss much. I would like to really hear you sing out on this one, though. It's a song I'd almost forgotten. I'd stopped singing. It was one I'd known way back around World War II. And then I heard somebody asked me for it. That was, and my golly, the words still rang true. United Nations make a change. Every link is freedom's name. Keep your hand on the plow. Hold on. Hold on. Hold on. Keep your hand on the plow. Hold on. You know, you can get a kind of repeat on that last chorus. Hold on. Hold on. Hold on. Hold on. Keep your hand on the plow. Hold on. Now, this is the kind of song, if you can't sing on, you can pat your feet. But you have to be in there somehow. It was taken, you know, from a real old one. Noah, Noah, let me come in. Doors all locked and the wind open. Keep your hand on the plow. Hold on. Hold on.
As he traveled around during this time, Pete came into several important songs that would eventually become quite famous. He would take his recording equipment with him and continue to operate as a folklorist, often recording tunes he had never heard before. He did this at places like Camp Rising Sun, an international summer camp in Rhinebeck, New York, as well as at Camp Woodland, near Phoenicia, New York, and the Catskill Mountains. There will be a later episode focusing on Pete's deep involvement with Camp Woodland, but given Seeger's participation there, we can't entirely overlook it here. Camp Woodland was an integrated summer camp program founded by educator Norman Studer in 1939 and ran every summer until it closed in 1962. Camp Woodland became an important setting for many youth to learn songs from the surrounding upstate New York region, and it was here that singer-songwriter Janis Ian and banjoist Eric Weisberg attended camp and were first exposed to Pete Seeger, who would come by frequently for extended stays and make tapes of songs and perform for the campers. It was at Woodland that Seeger first learned the song Guantanamera from a counselor in 1962. This counselor, named Hector Angulo, was a Cuban student studying at the Manhattan School of Music, who happened to play the song for Pete, who then made a recording and learned the song from Angulo directly. For those who do not know its history or its meaning, the refrain, Guajira Guantanamera, means Poor Woman of Guantanamo. Originally a more traditional love song, the verses that are most well known today were written by José Martí, the Cuban revolutionary who fought for Cuban independence from Spain in the 1890s. Martí had been exiled by the Spanish government and spent many years in New York City, and it was actually in New York State where he wrote his verses to Guantanamera. The song says, I am a poor man from the land of the palm trees, and before dying I wish to share these poems of my soul. Martí's words are very emotional when he says, my poems are soft green, but also flaming crimson. Martí is unique in that he mixes the anti-colonialist message in with how the emotions of one's landscape play a role in constructing one's politics, especially when he says, quote, with the poor people of this earth, I will share my fate. The splendor of the mountains pleases me more than the sea. Unquote. Amazingly, these verses were composed in the town of Haines Falls, New York, a dozen or so miles away from where Camp Woodland was actually located, when Martí was upstate recuperating from an illness at one point. Martí originally wrote many, many verses, but Pete traditionally would sing the Spanish verses of the translations I just gave. It's remarkable that this song was discovered in a place like this, in a way like this, but what it all shows is that this is precisely the folk process happening in one of the most organic ways possible. Throughout the 1960s and 70s, Guantanamera would become a crowd pleaser at Seeger concerts.
Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera. Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera. Yo soy un hombre sincero. De donde crece la palma, yo soy un hombre sincero. De donde crece la palma, antes de morir me quiero, echa mis versos del alma. Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera.
Another important song to come out of this period was the now famous Where Have All the Flowers Gone? Pete got the idea for this song in 1959 when he was on an airplane on his way to a performance. He had been reading the book And Quiet Flows the Dawn by Mikhail Sholokhov and came across the lines, Where are the flowers? The girls have plucked them. Where are the girls? They've all taken husbands. Where are the men? They're all in the army. These lines originally came from a Ukrainian folk song, but after searching for a year, Seeger never found the source. Pete borrowed the tune from an old Irish lumberjack song and then added the words, Long Time Passing, which had been in his head for a while. Seeger composed three verses to articulate the repetitive socio-political phenomenon of how people are born, marry, and go off to war. Each of the three verses respectively begins with, Where have all the flowers gone? Where have all the young girls gone? Where have all the young men gone? The song got its full length when Seeger visited Camp Woodland, where he discovered a counselor named Joe Hickerson had been singing it with the campers. Hickerson repeated the first verse at the end and added two more verses to give it a cyclical feel, saying that the men had gone to graveyards and the graveyards had turned to flowers.
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago. Where have all the flowers gone? The girls have picked them, everyone. Oh, when will you ever learn? Oh, when will you ever learn?
Flowers was later covered by many of the pop folk groups of the late 50s and early 60s. The Camp Woodland Kids taught it to Peter, Paul, and Mary in 1959, who had a hit with their version, and the Kingston Trio's cover was also quite famous. Just to note, there is a historical discrepancy about all this. Seeger always claimed that the trio heard the song and recorded it with Kingston Trio member Dave Gard's name on the tune, accidentally receiving credit. Seeger stated he called Gard, and Gard apologized, saying he would take his name off. The thing is that the story can't actually be possible. Why? Because Dave Gard is not on the recording, and had left the Kingston Trio and was preparing to move to Australia with his family at this time. Gard had since been replaced by banjoist and songwriter John Stewart, who is on the record. What is probable is that Pete got all this mixed up with the Kingston Trio when they might have been communicating about another song, or Pete might not have spoken to Gard about this, but another one of the members of the trio. Suffice it to say, hopefully the record is set straight now. Get it? Record? Anyway, here's a clip of the Kingston Trio's version.
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago. Where have all the flowers gone? Young girls pick them, everyone. When will they ever learn? When will they ever learn?
Where have all... Overall, this was a very productive period for Seeger. But nevertheless, it was still a very trying time. He continued to spend more time away from Beacon and his family, as he was forced to travel further and further away for jobs, sometimes hundreds or thousands of miles, performing up to 4 times a day. Eventually, the courts restricted his travel to the point that Seeger wasn't even allowed to leave the jurisdiction of the Southern District of New York. Paul Ross renegotiated this, however, and Seeger was allowed to travel more, but had to telegram and inform the court as to where he was going, the government effectively surveilling his every move. The Beacon community was also unwelcoming at times, with the local PTA dissolving its singing group because of Seeger's participation, and at one time an ignorant local set fires in the woods near the Seeger's house. This person was caught, but it was unsettling for the family. What was a real blow to Pete, though, was when his union, 802 of the American Federation of Musicians, attempted to revoke his membership in the organization because of Seeger's standing in the courts. Paul Ross came to Pete's aid here and stopped the musicians' union from doing this, reminding them that, at the time, Seeger had not actually been charged with or convicted of anything. This would have created many problems, as it would have precluded Pete from performing in certain places that required union membership. It's ironic and disappointing that the union Pete had been in since 1942 would try to expel him for such reasons, especially after all Seeger had done organizing and singing for the labor movement. This was just one more thing that was reflective of the times and how labor had moved to the right in the post-war era. It is also worth mentioning that Pete wasn't the only member of the Seeger clan to be affected by the blacklist. Pete's father, Charles, was also under investigation. The FBI had come to his house in 1952 and had grilled him for information. He confessed to having been a member of the Composers Collective back in the 30s, and they inquired further about his anti-war stance at Berkeley long before that. Everything seemed to be in their files. The next day, Charles resigned from his government job, just 2 years shy of a full pension, and moved his family from Maryland to Boston. In a sad state of affairs, Pete's stepmother Ruth, who had been ill with cancer, passed away soon after all this. Charles also eventually had his passport suddenly revoked with no explanation. Pete's siblings were also under attack, specifically with his sister Peggy eventually having her passport revoked when traveling back and forth to Europe, as the FBI had a file on her. Additionally, because of his brother's reputation, Mike Seeger had trouble keeping a couple of jobs of his own working for the government. Hopefully it's clear by now that when Pete sang the song Wasn't That a Time, he really did sing from his own experience.
the madmen come. And shall our victory fail? There is no victory in a land where free men go to jail. Isn't this a time? Isn't this a time? A time to try?
Eventually, Pete was forced to face the music, as it were. In 1957, Seeger was indicted by a grand jury on 10 counts of contempt of Congress, and finally went on trial in March 1961. The presiding judge was a man named Thomas Murphy, who ironically had seen Seeger perform with the Weavers at the Blue Angel nightclub several years before. The government's prosecuting attorney was a man named Irving Younger. According to an interview Seeger did with Sonia Malkin on WKNY Radio in Kingston, New York, in January 1962, this had basically been Younger's first case. Paul Ross faced a challenging cross-examination on that day. Judge Murphy excluded over 100 of Ross's questions, and every time Ross challenged HUAC's authority, Judge Murphy excused the jury from the room. Ross actually managed to bring in Congressman Walter and have him on the stand. Walter was asked if he knew people at the publication firm Aware Incorporated, another organization like American Business Consultants that labeled alleged communists like Counterattack did. Walter denied knowing anyone there, but at a later point, Ross had someone from Aware Incorporated on the stand who testified under oath that they did know Walter and that they had met with him. Ross was trying to criticize HUAC's integrity, except that the jury had been excused and they didn't hear any of it. Younger charged the jury by saying that Seeger had not cooperated with HUAC and that the contempt charges were legal and justified. The jury left at 3:30 p.m. and returned 80 minutes later with a verdict: guilty. Seeger was to be sentenced in 6 days.
Glory shall rest on us all, yet she's only as rich as the poorest of the poor, only as free as a padlocked prison door. Only as strong as our love for this land, only as tall as we stand. For here is a land full of power and glory, beauty that words cannot recall. All her power shall rest on the strength of her freedom. Glory shall rest on us all. Come on and take a walk with me through this green.
A surprised Pete Seeger was led away handcuffed while Toshi lifted Pete's banjo from his shoulder, their children Danny and Mika looking on at this legal spectacle. Paul Ross hurried over to the Court of Appeals to ask them to set bail, and Harold Leventhal started driving around town to acquire the bail itself. Pete was held for about 6 hours downstairs in a jail cell while bail was arranged. The petition for bail was set at $2,000 cash, which Paul Ross, Toshi, and Harold counted out for the clerk from what Harold had gotten from friends and others in Manhattan that afternoon. For those that are asking whether Pete did the right thing by going through all these loops and hurdles to stand up for people's rights like this, this is what Pete explained about his logic. Quote, "It's a hard thing to explain, but when you're following what you think is the right course, it may not be fun, but you feel a certain satisfaction in doing it." Unquote. The sentence ended up being 10 years in jail, but these could be served concurrently. Thus, the sentence technically only ended up being a year in jail. The case went through another appeal, and a year later, in May 1962, the Court of Appeals ruled that the charges against Seeger were legally faulty, and the case was dismissed. What was the basis of the court's decision? In their view, HUAC's role in legal authority had been unclear. Seeger rolled his eyes at this. He had wanted to attack every piece of all this hypocrisy, and to be dismissed on some strange technicality was a bit underwhelming. But, on the other hand, he was acquitted, and it was over. The court did get their licks in one last time, though, when they stated, quote, "We are not inclined to dismiss lightly claims of constitutional stature because they are asserted by one who may appear untrustworthy of sympathy." Unquote. In other words, the court did not like Seeger or what he stood for, even if they acquitted him. But an acquittal is an acquittal. As the old adage goes, take it easy, but take it.
Well,
Well, out in Detroit, here's what they found. Down in Pittsburgh, here's what they found. Down in Bethlehem, here's what they found. Out in Frisco, here's what they found. That if you don't let red baiting break you up, if you don't let stool pigeons break you up, if you don't let race hatred break you up, if you don't let vigilantes break you up, you'll win. What I mean, take it easy, but take it.
Now, while Pete wouldn't be on television for a while longer, with the foundation he had laid in the 50s, and with contempt of Congress no longer hanging over his head, his audiences would continue to grow, his songs would be heard more, and soon he would be signed to Columbia Records, and in 1963 would do his first world tour. But why did the blacklisting of Pete Seeger happen? It's possible HUAC and their network understood Seeger and disagreed with his pro-labor, pro-civil rights, and more leftist political leanings, and wanted to silence him for advocating for a more fair and equal society for all. It's also possible that they just wanted to label him as a communist because they themselves were ignorant about how the world worked. It's also possible that it was a combination of both of these things to some degree, a mashup of ignorance and diabolical cleverness. We are often faced with this question about power. That is, which one of these is it? Often it's hard to know for sure, and this is likely one of those times. We can probably conclude, however, that these were all going on at different lengths in some capacity. It's also important to compare the blacklist of the mid-20th century to similar practices occurring today. The impacts of Cold War fear and stereotypes remain, and many, if not most, productive discussions surrounding what is needed to fix our society continue to be shot down by the same discourses and fear campaigns that were launched over 75 years ago. The legacy of the blacklist has yet to be resolved, and continues to be reproduced in new and different ways. Pete's story and the music are here, though, and they can teach us how to understand all this. To conclude our episode, let's hear a statement Pete gave in 1980 summarizing the implications of the blacklist. It's interesting to compare what Pete was thinking over 40 years ago to what is going on now.
But I don't know, maybe in the long run, maybe we made better music for being blacklisted. Who knows? It would have been nice if there had been no blacklist. I say it would have been nicer for America if there had been no blacklist. I'd be even nicer for America if there was no blacklist now. Of all the good things, because the media has the greatest chance in the world to do things, good things. And it's in a commercial straitjacket. In other places, it may be in a political straitjacket, but here's a commercial and political straitjacket, too.
Hey, folks. Thanks for joining us for this episode. This was a hefty one, longer than I wanted, and maybe had a copious quantity of detail beyond that which I was expecting. I like getting these out once per month. It's been about 6 weeks, so I'm sorry if you were waiting. What a prolific period of time for Pete Seeger's music. What a trying time. Wasn't that a time for Pete Seeger just politically? And what he was facing. And listen to all those records and albums from the 50s over time, but never really had a deep appreciation for how difficult it was to make all of them, and the need to make all of them, to do all that work. And Pete really saw he had an opportunity, and really believed he could reach people by doing all of that. As we'll learn, he did reach people, and those records had an impact, and the interactions at the summer camps and at the schools had an impact. It was very pervasive. So it's easy, I think, to wax nostalgic with all of this and just be purely reminiscent or reflective, but we don't want to be just nostalgic for a particular period of time. We want to realize that music is a resource, and Pete Seeger's albums are still resources. He put out so many records with folkways, and there's so much good music there. And if you don't know any of it, It's accessible. You can go look it up. And I highly encourage you to be proactive and to do that. Pete wouldn't want you just to sit back and absorb and consume. He would want you to be involved on your own level. And that was just even more clear to me than it ever was before by doing the research for the show, this episode here. I don't want to get too long-winded. So we have our first person join the Patreon, and I'd love it if other people joined. It would be fantastic. Please consider being a part of all that. Our next episodes get us into the 60s and Columbia Records and new performances, so that should be pretty exciting, so stay tuned. There Is a Season, the Pete Seeger podcast, is written, recorded, and produced by Adam C. Morse. See you all next time.